Welcome to Music for Life, exploring the purpose and value of music to humanity's enrichment. I'm your host, Ryan Malone. This is Jean-Baptiste Arban's famous Carnival of Venice Variations, and it is an example of some of the hardest music written for the trumpet. And in today's episode, we will explore music written to showcase the highest level of performance achievement, otherwise known as virtuosity. In our Sounds of Scripture segment, we will discuss the Bible's endorsement of virtuosity and explore some of the cunning, skillful virtuosi of the biblical record. For our backstage banter, Oklahoma violin legend Kyle Dillingham shares his thoughts about how the concept of virtuosity has changed for violinists over the years.
I think that if you look back historically, the idea of virtuosity was a different thing. There were often great improvisers. I always imagined that the performances were a little bit more on the edge.
And for our classroom corner, we will explore how virtuosity is developed, the parents' role in that, and we hear from legendary violinist Joshua Bell on the subject.
For me, it's always been about quality of time rather than amount of time.
And he gives some specific tips on how to spend that time. All this and more on today's episode of Music for Life, Music for Virtuosity. This is the first episode I'm recording after an inspiring trip my family and I took to the Philippines. We spent almost 2 weeks there working with some of the musicians in that area, a country certainly ripe for strong musical education. There is a passion for the musical arts in that country overall, and it was exciting to be able to build on that. We also discovered an overwhelming amount of support for this program. We have many, many devoted listeners throughout that country. So I promised them I would give a little shout-out, as it were, to them and thank them for their support. And thanks to all those listening to this program around the world. Your support, your ratings, your reviews on iTunes, your tweets, your posts are all much appreciated, as that expands the social media footprint of this show and its potential global reach. So today we're talking about virtuosity in the musical repertoire. Virtuosity can be defined as great skill in music or another artistic pursuit. So I guess, although you could be an engineering virtuoso, the moniker is more common in the arts, particularly the musical arts. Composers throughout history have found wonderful ways to demonstrate the skill level of those who perform their music, which of course makes for a challenging learning process for the performer, but certainly adds to the entertainment value, frankly, of the performance, seeing the dazzle and the wonderment of a disciplined artist. Before we go through some of these examples in music history, I want to establish a bit of a foundation by starting with our Sounds of Scripture segment, where we survey the Bible's many references to music for a longer sweeping historical perspective on our episode's theme. And we'll see the biblical record stance on virtuosity, which I believe is a good way to introduce this subject. Psalm 33, verses 2 and 3 read, "Praise the Eternal with harp, sing unto him with the psaltery, and an instrument of 10 strings. Sing unto him a new song, play skillfully with a loud noise." There are some commands in the Psalms to make a joyful noise, and others that endorse the idea of playing skillfully. The Bible endorses both amateur musical involvement in worship on a more congregational level, as well as the idea of perfecting music, making it as good and beautiful as possible, as the word skillfully means here, in the context of worship. Both are valid and have their place, but let's explore this idea of virtuosity as found in the biblical record, as well as some of the virtuosi of the Bible. The most prominent virtuoso of biblical times, and one whose skills set the standard for the culture of the ancient Hebrews, was none other than King David. His musical prowess is noted long before he took Israel's throne. When King Saul's servants suggested that Saul search out a cunning harp player from the nation to soothe his troubled mind, one of them knew just the person for the job, and it was a teenager from the rural town of Bethlehem. This servant seemed to know a fair bit about this young man. It says in 1 Samuel 16, verse 18, "Then answered one of the servants and said, 'Behold, I have seen a son of Jesse the Bethlehemite that is cunning in playing, and a mighty valiant man, and a man of war, and prudent in matters, and a comely person, and the Lord is with him.'" David's reason for being called to the court first off was because he was cunning in playing. That was the gig, that was the job. That phrase, cunning in playing, literally means to be skillful in striking the strings. The word for cunning also implies the ability to teach. So David was already quite advanced on the harp, even as a teenager. He was what we might call a musical prodigy, but definitely a virtuoso. Alfred Sendri writes about this account in his book Music in Ancient Israel. "A simple shepherd," he writes, "so extraordinarily well-versed in playing the kinnor, the Hebrew word for harp, that even the functionaries of the royal court took cognizance of it, should certainly appear as something quite incredible for those times. Things become different, however, when we consider that kinnor playing shepherd boy as no more than a cross-section of the music culture of that epoch." Sendri supposes that David wasn't the only shepherd harpist around, and not the only virtuoso either, but in addition to being highly skilled, he also possessed all these other character traits that Saul's servant knew would allow him to be suited for life in the royal court. Sendri continues, "One may well surmise the existence of numerous other players of the kinnor, among whom David stood out as being uncommonly talented. His ability of playing the kinnor has been the immediate cause for his invitation to the court, and consequently it was the starting point of his future ascendance." Well, his encounter with Samuel in Bethlehem that happened earlier, I think that would have been his starting point. But as far as being noticed by the rest of the nation, it really did start with this gig in Saul's court. Once king of Israel, though, David surrounded himself with other musical virtuosi. This presupposes that the culture was already endorsing virtuosic development of musicians. Evidence of this can be found in the schooling that the prophet Samuel established throughout the nation. His company of prophets were known for their musical skills long before David came on the scene. We've talked about that in previous episodes. King David, though, was able to harness this skilled musical culture, which had been established by Samuel, and create a culture of virtuosity in both the royal court and the sacred activities. For example, when he moved the Ark of the Covenant to Jerusalem in his second attempt, when he involved these skilled Levites, several Levites are named for their involvement in the musical procession. One man named is Chenaniah, who in this particular event was in charge of the performance. 1 Chronicles 15:22 says, "And Chenaniah, chief of the Levites, was for song. He instructed about the song because he was skillful." The Authorized Version of the Bible captures the musical essence of this verse, as the Hebrew for "was for song" does not of itself indicate anything musical. Many King James Version margins will say "was for song" literally means in the Hebrew "was for the carriage." By looking at the context, however, we see that this verse indeed contains a musical reference, and here's what those margins mean by carriage. The word for the phrase "was for song," or "for the carriage," is masa, meaning to lift up or carry. The root means to carry, assist, or support. This is in a musical context, And Hananiah is later mentioned as the master of the song, the margin again saying master of the carriage, with the singers. Master of the carriage with the singers. The Hebrew then makes it clear that Hananiah supported or lifted up this performance by instructing and refining the singers. After all, he was skillful, it says. It appears that Hananiah was the choir master in this particular performance. His instruction, it seems, had the ability to show the singers how to get more power and resonance out of their sound to lift up their voices even more. After the Ark was established in Jerusalem, King David set up some of the musicians involved into a more permanent role. This applied namely to three of these men and their families, Asaph, Yeduthun, and Heman. 1 Chronicles 25 discusses this and summarizes in verse 7, "So the number of them with their brethren that were instructed in the songs of the Lord, even all that were cunning, was 288. All in all, 288 instructed in the songs of the Lord, a noble accolade afforded to those who were cunning, the same word used earlier to describe David's harp playing. Again, that word in the Hebrew means to discern, understand, consider, and even to give insight and understanding, that is, to teach. These were brilliant musicians, real professionals, so they could achieve the highest standard in music making before the Ark of God. Sendri says that the musicians David chose achieved a mastery, quote, maintained invariably on a high level by the strict discipline of the Guild of Musicians and by constant music rehearsals, for these Levites were provided with special rooms as stated in the Bible, Ezekiel 40, verse 44, and in the rabbinic literature, unquote. Sendri references a chamber of the singers in a temple that's described in Ezekiel 40 through 48. The fact that this grand structure includes rehearsal rooms for the singers shows the importance of musicians having the resources to perfect their skills to the highest degree. David's pattern of priestly courses was transferred to the temple after it was built by Solomon. Throughout the history surrounding David's throne and the temple, we see the same level of virtuosity being espoused in the temple from time to time. One such time was under the influence of Jehoiada the priest. There's a passing reference to the musical culture of the Levites at that time. Jehoiada had secretly kept the heir of the throne alive, while the evil queen mother thought she had destroyed the entire dynasty. Jehoiada was ready to crown the 7-year-old heir and displace Queen Mother Athaliah. He did so swiftly inside the heavily guarded temple on a Sabbath day, and 2 Chronicles 23 verses 12 to 13 read, "Now when Athaliah heard the noise of the people running and praising the king, she came to the people into the house of the Lord, and she looked, and behold, the king stood at his pillar at the entering in, and the princes and the trumpets by the king, and all the people of the land rejoiced and sounded with trumpets, also the singers with instruments of music and such as taught to sing praise. Then Athaliah rent her clothes and said, 'Treason, treason.'" This gives us a glimpse at the state of the temple music service under Jehoiada the priest, even while an evil queen mother reigned. There were the silver trumpets, of course, singers with the instruments of singing, as it literally reads, and even such as taught to sing praise. Jehoiada had set up a music education program in the temple for those who taught. The word taught is the same Hebrew word used to describe David's cunning harp playing. Verses 17 to 18 of that same chapter read this way, "Then all the people went to the house of Baal and broke it down and broke his altars and his images in pieces and slew Matan the priest of Baal before the altars. Also Jehoiada appointed the offices of the house of the Lord by the hand of the priests, the Levites, whom David had distributed in the house of the Lord, to offer the burnt offerings of the Lord, as it is written in the law of Moses, with rejoicing and with singing, as it was ordained by David." Jehoiada restored the law of Moses and the musical service of David. Here is reiterated the fact that David instituted the musical portion of the worship service and that it was an art form which required special training to master. Another reference to skilled or virtuoso performers has a uniquely dark element. funeral dirges in the Hebrew culture were performed by the best-trained female singers. A prophecy in Jeremiah 9 discusses this. Verses 16 to 17 read, "I will scatter them also among the heathen, whom neither they nor their fathers have known, and I will send a sword after them till I have consumed them. Thus says the Eternal of Hosts, consider and call for the mourning women that they may come, and send for cunning women that they may come." These cunning, mourning women, the Moffat translation renders it, were well skilled in dirges. Verses 18 to 21 tell these virtuoso women to train their daughters even in the same kind of wailing and lamentation. It says, "For death has come up into our windows and has entered into our palaces to cut off the children from without and the young men from the streets." This dark, sobering prophecy tells these mourning women that times were coming that would be so bad that their daughters needed to be skilled in how to sing for many funerals. One other reference to skilled performers in the Hebrew culture comes during a time of captivity, as referenced in Psalm 137. In this psalm, those who were taken captive refused to sing their sacred music in a strange land. The psalmist states, "If I forget you, O Jerusalem, let my right hand forget her cunning. If I do not remember you, let my tongue cleave to the roof of my mouth, if I prefer not Jerusalem above my chief joy." As favorable as the Bible is toward the highest of musical accomplishment and virtuosity, this psalm puts other things in perspective next to it, having the proper focus on Jerusalem and all that it represents. Making it the chief joy of the performer is stated here as being more important than mere personal skill or accomplishment. This has been Sounds of Scripture.
Let my right hand forget her still, if Jerusalem I forget. If I fail to remember thee, let my tongue cleave unto my mouth. But we thought
you are listening to Music for Life. I'm your host, Ryan Malone. This is KPCG. Today we are exploring Music for Virtuosity, compositions intended to showcase the highest level of performance achievement for a particular instrument. Virtuosity became a big element of music in the 19th century, what we call the Romantic era. This was a time when music was being performed less as background music at aristocratic functions and more in front of an audience made up of hard-working middle-class patrons. A slightly less educated audience may not have appreciated the more cerebral elements of certain compositions, but they certainly could all agree on the fact that the music was being performed at an impressive rate of speed, say, or that the performer was executing amazing acrobatics on the instrument. Virtuosity became an important element in these public concerts, and so the music more commonly demonstrated these characteristics in the Romantic era. But virtuosity was required in compositions many years before that. If we start with the Baroque era of the standard repertoire, the late 17th to early 18th centuries, we see composers demanding quite a bit from their performers. Let's start with an example from the vocal tradition. In opera, demanding vocal passages would certainly wow the audience and maintain their interest. Vivaldi was known for writing extremely challenging vocal solos in his operas. These were brought more into the limelight by the modern mezzo-soprano Cecilia Bartoli in an all-Vivaldi album she released back in 1999. I played one of these arias from her Vivaldi album back in an early episode of this program, but let's go ahead and hear another one. This is an aria from Il Tamerlano. It has fast, melismatic passages, known commonly as coloratura, and this also has fast, repeated notes, which is extremely difficult to perform on the human voice. Ha ha ha! That was Cecilia Bartoli with Il Giardino Armonico performing an aria from Vivaldi's Il Tamerlano. And that was an example of virtuosity in Baroque vocal music. Baroque composers also required virtuosity of their instrumental performers. One kind of piece that originated in the Baroque era, a genre that is still composed today, is called a toccata. A toccata is considered a virtuosic piece of music that possesses an improvisatory feel. This improvisatory nature makes it sound as though the performer is making up impressive passages on the spot. It usually contains fast-moving runs, unsteady rhythms and harmonies, full chords, and polyphonic passages, clearly designed to demonstrate the ability of the performer. The most famous toccata is the Toccata and Fugue in D minor by J.S. Bach. Here is just the famous toccata portion. Sure, this toccata has been used and abused by people wanting to use it for spooky effects, which is not how I think Bach intended it at all. But listen to the improvisatory and virtuosic nature of this recording. Here it is performed on the organ by British-born organist E. Power Biggs. That was the toccata from J.S. Bach's famous Toccata and Fugue in D minor, performed by organist E. Power Biggs. We are talking about music that was written to demonstrate virtuosity, because that sounds nicer than show-off music. The toccata was an improvisatory and impressive-sounding instrumental piece. Even into the modern era, composers write toccatas, and they are usually characterized by a steady stream of quick passages, like in this toccata by Debussy. Thank you. and in this toccata by Ravel. Another way composers were able to show off a solo instrumentalist's skills was by putting the soloist up against an orchestra. Featuring a solo instrument alongside an orchestra is a type of piece known as a concerto. And in nearly every concerto, there is a specific moment where the orchestra stops entirely while the instrumentalist is to play a showy, improvisatory-sounding section. This section was known as the cadenza. Cadenza is an Italian word meaning cadence. In Baroque music, at the end of vocal arias, the singer would often be asked to improvise or embellish the vocal line on one of the last chords just before the music came to its final cadence, or its final chord. On one of those chords preceding the final cadence, a chord that was more unstable, the singer would improvise briefly before the aria rested on its final stable chord. This began to be used in concerti, and by the classical era, the time period that followed the Baroque era, it became quite standardized as to when and how this cadenza would happen. So now when we think of a cadenza, we are talking about a section featured in virtually every concerto when the soloist plays alone without any orchestral accompaniment. And it is a section noted by difficult, often heavily ornamented passages, which allows the soloist to demonstrate his or her skill with the instrument. In the past, these cadenzas were often improvised. Mozart, for example, who possessed excellent improvisatory skills, is believed to have improvised his own cadenzas at his concerts. Thus, this section of his score was left totally blank, allowing him to freely demonstrate his virtuosity. Basically, it would just be a big rest with a fermata over it saying, cadenza. And then the composer would just take it from there, and then the conductor would know at a certain point when the composer or the performer was intending for the orchestra to come back in and finish off the movement. In Mozart's Piano Concerto No. 21 in C, K467, the cadenza is left entirely blank like this, so it's clear Mozart expected to improvise this solo passage live. So if you hear a recording of this concerto, realize that the cadenza section is not Mozart's writing at all. It's probably been written by the soloist, or the soloist is using one of a handful of cadenzas that have been written since Mozart's time. Now, these cadenzas all usually take main themes and musical ideas from other parts of the movement and perform them in more technically challenging ways. Here's an example of pianist Rudolf Zerkin, Claudio Abbado conducting the London Symphony Orchestra, and this is the cadenza at the end of the first movement of this concerto. This is a cadenza not by Mozart. You'll also hear how the orchestra rests on an unstable chord just before the soloist starts the cadenza. Thank you. So that was an example of a cadenza, a long solo passage that, in this case, wasn't written by the composer. It was expected that the composer would improvise this section based on themes and musical ideas from earlier in the movement. In the classical era, this large cadenza almost always occurred near the end of a concerto's first movement, the biggest movement of the standard three movements in a concerto. And this section precedes a final section played by just the orchestra, which you just heard. The orchestra stopped on that unstable chord, the soloist played for a couple of minutes, and then the orchestra came back in and finished the movement. This was a common, formulaic, predictable element of all concerti in the classical era. To demonstrate that, let me play you several more examples of the chords that would lead into the cadenza section. Here's the orchestral lead-in to the cadenza of one of Mozart's horn concertos. Listen for these chords that set up the cadenza. Here's another orchestral lead into a cadenza in Mozart's oboe concerto. Listen to the chords that lead in to this solo passage. Even later, when Beethoven was writing concerti, like in his violin concerto, the orchestra played a very similar formulaic chord structure or chord progression to lead to that unstable chord that set up the cadenza. So whenever you hear these chords or a similar chord progression toward the end of the first movement of a classical concerto, you know a cadenza is coming. You can also tell when the cadenza is about over in a classical concerto because the soloist usually does a large trill, signaling to the audience and to the conductor that he or she is almost done showing off and it's time for the orchestra to take back over. So let's hear some examples from those cadenzas we just started a little bit of. Let's listen to the end of those cadenzas. Here's the Mozart Horn Concerto. And here's the Mozart Oboe Concerto. Now, for the most part, composers would write out their cadenzas as they wanted them performed by the soloist. They would write them in such a way, though, to sound improvised, much like those toccatas of the Baroque era, and they would also be written to showcase everything the instrumentalist was capable of. Let's hear one last example of a cadenza. This is from the concerto-like piece that we use as the opening and closing themes for this show, Mozart's Sinfonia Concertante in E-flat. This is essentially a double concerto for both violin and viola, so Mozart couldn't have both instruments simply improvising randomly at the same time, so he wrote out a cadenza to sound improvisatory and impressive. Here it is, and again, this would be toward the end of the first movement. Thank you. Okay, the show isn't over, even though that's the music we use at the very end of each episode. You are listening to Music for Life. I'm your host, Ryan Malone. This is KPCG. Today we are exploring Music for Virtuosity. That was the end of the first movement of the Sinfonia Concertante by Mozart, performed by Zubin Mehta and the Israel Philharmonic, with violin soloist Itzhak Perlman and viola soloist Pinchas Zukerman. That was the cadenza section. That was the orchestra leading into that unstable chord, which set up this solo section, well, really a duet section for both instruments, the section where the orchestra takes a break, and then the instrumentalists demonstrate their skills without the assistance of the orchestra. And then you heard the heightened intensity of the trills at the end of that cadenza, which led right back into the orchestra taking over and finishing the first movement. So we've listened to several examples from the classical era illustrating this idea of cadenza. Now let's move into the Romantic era, the time period in the 19th century where, as we stated earlier, the element of virtuosity was very important to musical composition. This was the time of several great virtuoso performers who were also composers. One such example is Franz Liszt, who lived from 1811 to 1886. Many of Liszt's contemporaries said that he was the most technically advanced pianist of the age, and audiences received him with the kind of fervor and excitement that we might equate with modern audiences receiving pop sensations. We're going to listen to a great showy piece by Franz Liszt. This is the Mephisto Waltz, performed by Yevgeny Kissin. Thank you. That was pianist Yevgeny Kissin performing Franz Liszt's Mephisto Waltz. Liszt was one of the great virtuoso pianists of his day, and he required massive technical feats in his piano compositions. And that's what we are exploring today on Music for Life, Music for Virtuosity. When we come back, we're going to talk about another great virtuoso performer and composer of the Romantic era, Paganini. We will also hear from violinist Kyle Dillingham about the Romantic era's view of virtuosity. We will also explore some of the hardest pieces written for piano and violin, one that was considered even unplayable in parts. And we will also have a special Classroom Corner segment where we hear from legendary violinist Joshua Bell on the subject of quality practicing. We'll be right back.